Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Author Bill Bryson is one of a legion of fans with such bestsellers as A Walk in the Woods, A Short History of Nearly Everything, At Home, and many more. His latest is a gold mine for history buffs as he focuses on an extraordinary year in U.S. history, 1927. There were major events, to be sure, the Lindbergh flight and Babe Ruth's 60 home run year, but there were also flappers, flagpole sitters, and films, talking films. They and much more, including a significant role for St. Louis, are included in Bill Bryson's new book, One Summer, America 1927. Bill Bryson joins us by phone to talk about the book and about himself. Bill, it's so nice to talk with you.
Hi, hello. It's a great pleasure to be talking with you.
You know, I'm within 60 pages of finishing the book. I raced this morning hoping I could, but I've really, really enjoyed the read so far. It's wonderfully done.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks. I hope I don't disappoint you in the home stretch.
Oh, I'm sure you will not. I'll get to where I am right now, which is the eugenics portion of the book. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But let's just kind of set this whole thing up. Why did you look particularly at 1927?
My starting point was not 1927 at all, really. And my starting point was that I'd always been kind of fascinated by the fact that these two iconic events happened in the same summer. Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, and Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. And I just had it vaguely in mind that it might be interesting to try to write a dual biography of these two guys, two, you know, very different characters, whose fates came together in this one summer when their stories intersected, and I that was as much as I thought. It was just two fascinating people. I love baseball. I'd always wanted to do a book with baseball in it, but I was quite fascinated by Charles Lindbergh too and his flight, and so that was all I was thinking. But then I discovered, as you've mentioned in your introduction, that all this other stuff happened in the same summer, and a lot of it's forgotten. A lot of it is also very well known, but nobody ever really noticed all this stuff was going on at the same time. So, I mean, it's possible to read wonderful biographies of Lindbergh or Babe Ruth and have no idea that at the same time there was the Mississippi flood or the carving of Mount Rushmore or the invention of television or all this other stuff that was happening simultaneously. So I quite early on realized that the story, as far as I was concerned, was not just these two guys and their great events, but the whole summer and the whole period in which they were doing it.
There's only one other year that I can think of off the top of my head that might be in some ways comparable, and that would be 1968 with all that was going on with assassinations and with Vietnam and moon flights and all the rest of it. Another fairly incredible year. But yours certainly was filled with a lot of stuff, as they say.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you're absolutely right. And it is interesting that, you know, I mean, it's obviously just random, but it is interesting how from time to time you get years that are suddenly very eventful, you know, that there wasn't any particular reason why 1968 should have had all that stuff happening. And in the same way, 1927, you know, it's almost entirely coincidental that all this stuff happened at the same time. I mean, you know, Lindbergh didn't fly the Atlantic because Babe Ruth was hitting 60 home runs. I mean, they had no connection at all, except that they were just happening at the same time. But I find that fascinating. I mean, I don't think it's fateful or anything, but I just find it fascinating that there are certain times when that have become, you know, just sort of magically eventful. And 1927 was certainly that.
It certainly was. Again, your story is told so well, with Lindbergh and Babe Ruth being kind of a thread that runs throughout. Bill, set the stage for us, would you, in not necessarily copious detail, but maybe the Cliff Notes version of what life in America was like during the 20s.
Well, I think one of the first things we noticed was it was a lot emptier. There were only 40% as many people as today, so you know, fewer than half as many people. And also, I think the thing that would have really been striking is, you know, that there were no highways, by and large, between towns, even as late as 1927. You know, I grew up in Des Moines, and if I'd wanted to come and visit you in St. Louis, I would have almost certainly come by train. That was how you got from place to place, and that was how things got from place to place. That was how products were distributed. So it was a much simpler world in which information didn't travel as fast as now, and people physically didn't travel anything like as fast as now. And part of what was so magical about Lindbergh's flight to people was this thought that not only was it possible to fly a across oceans. But now we'd, you know, you'd be able to go from St. Louis to Chicago in, you know, an hour and a half or something, instead of taking all day, and that kind of thing. The possibility of getting across country in a single bound was just almost indescribably exciting to people.
Well, another thing that people couldn't do during that period, of course, was drink. It was right in the middle of Prohibition.
Well, you have to sort of qualify that. The one thing they couldn't do was drink legally.
Right,
they
exactly.
They certainly drank. It was an interesting fact. I didn't realize this, but it was an interesting fact that by, you know, virtually every measure, people did more drinking during Prohibition than they did outside Prohibition. And worse drinking, the kind of drinking that was bad for them. Because, first of all, people were consuming a lot of sort of bootleg stuff and bathtub gin and kind of, you know, dangerously unregulated hooch. But also, because in most places you couldn't get beer or wine, people were driven to drink stronger stuff, you know, real rot gut stuff. And so all of that fed a sort of air of abandon, which really became the kind of theme for the whole of the 13 years of Prohibition. So Prohibition was the greatest failure in social experimentation that's probably ever happened anywhere on Earth.
Well, a very disturbing segment of your book dealing with this and the fact that the drinking, as people were in those days, could be very, very dangerous because of what the government was doing unbeknownst to those drinkers. And it was, it's unconscionable what was happening. Tell us about that part of it.
Yeah, I think this is the single most astonishing thing I learned in doing the book, which was that the government, our own government, was, you know, intentionally, randomly, but intentionally poisoning batches of industrial alcohol, so that with the idea that it would maim or kill anyone who drank it, as a way of discouraging other people from drinking at all. It was their way of enforcing prohibition. So the thing they didn't think about when they brought prohibition in as a law was that you can ban all the intoxicating beverages, but you still, any society needs lots and lots of industrial alcohol because you need it for making paint thinners and nail varnish and all kinds of stuff like that. And so millions and millions of gallons of legal alcohol were still being made, and it was really quite a simple matter to divert that, some of that, or even quite a lot of that, and convert it into, you know, drinkable, not very high quality, but certainly drinkable, potable intoxicants. And people were doing that. And so the government, under pressure from the people with dries, started tipping poisons into strychnine and mercury and things like that into industrial alcohol, so that if it did get diverted, people would be killed or crippled or blinded or otherwise, you know, severely distressed. And that was just the most amazing thing, to think that our own government was, you know, willfully, if randomly, killing its own citizens.
Well, there are a number of dark moments like that, and we'll get to some of them as we continue the conversation. What was the gentleman's name who was responsible for this? He was an avid prohibitionist. Was it Wheeler?
Yeah, Wayne Bidwell Wheeler.
Yeah, well, he met a bad end after all of this. And how many people died? I don't recall the number.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody knows. And the figures are sort of wildly inconsistent. From one source to another. It may have been, you know, in any given year, it may have been a few dozen, or it may have been, some people have listed numbers in the thousands. So it seems, you know, that there's a lot of guesswork going on there. One of the problems you get is that, you know, if your brother or grandfather or whatever died from poisoned alcohol, some people might not recognize that. They might think that he just had a heart attack or something. And also, you might persuade the doctor to fill out the death certificate in some way that was made him seem a little more innocent. So quite a few deaths may have been kind of covered up or not even recognized as alcohol-induced deaths. But there was certainly, you know, a number. I mean, there was, you know, and it was an absolute fact that a lot of industrial alcohol was severely poisonous.
And no one except the victims was ever penalized for any of that.
Yeah, and most of the other thing that's important to bear in mind was another reason why the numbers are so uncertain is that most of the adulterated alcohol, the poison stuff, ended up going to people at the kind of lower end of the drinking scale. I mean, you know, middle-class people tended to have reliable suppliers, and so they tended to drink good, clean stuff. If this was Prohibition and, you know, you and I were going out to get stuff, we'd probably be getting, you know, real whiskey from brought over from Canada or something. It was people more at the lower end of the drinking scale, more, you know, kind of hopeless alcoholics and people at a more indigent level of society who were ending up drinking the bad stuff. And if they tumbled over and died in a gutter somewhere, then, you know, people weren't all that concerned.
All of this, as you point out in the book, was helpful to people like Al Capone because what they were providing their customers could be more trusted.
Exactly. I mean, people went to Al Capone, relied on Al Capone, and people like him in other cities, because, you know, you could count on it. He wasn't going to poison you. He provided reliable stuff. As part of the reason that people, you know, admired him and liked him so much, because he was, you know, he was a decent supplier. Apart from the fact that he was doing, you know, terribly brutal and illegal things, Al Capone was also a great businessman. And, you know, in some respects, he deserves some kind of credit for that because he ran one of the biggest business empires in America and ran it really well and provided good, sound, you know, reliable products that people appreciated having.
And it's ironic. I think most people probably know the story that Al Capone was not brought down by any rival, but brought down by Uncle Sam, or should I say Aunt Samantha, because he was brought down basically by a woman.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful story. There's this extraordinary woman named Mabel Walker Willebrand who worked for the Justice Department, and all the mobsters had previously been pretty well invincible because, you know, nobody would give evidence against them because, you know, you'd be shot in the knees, you'd disappear into the nearest lake or something. So it was just foolish and suicidal to give evidence. So they seemed to be pretty well safe from any kind of prosecution. And she was the one who came up with the idea of, look, these guys are all self-evidently rich, and yet they're not paying income taxes, so let's get them for income tax evasion. And that was such a kind of out-of-left-field idea that it took people a while to think, actually, that's not a bad approach. But it was, of course, and it was such a good approach that they're still using it. And Al Capone was kind of the first big victim of that. That was what led to his downfall was, as you say, not violence or actual criminality, but just tax evasion.
You're listening to Bill Bryson. He's the author of One Summer, America, 1927. We're going to continue this conversation in just a little bit. We have to take a break, Bill. We'll do that now, come back, and continue talking about that wonderful year in so many ways and dreadful in so many others. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with author Bill Bryson. His latest book is One Summer, America, 1927. What was the American public so fascinated by with regard to aviation, Bill? You've already alluded to the fact it was difficult to get from one place to another. Is that why folks were so into flying and aviation?
Well, it was an exciting new phenomenon, and the heyday of aviation had been really the World War One, and because that was when suddenly planes were used, you know, pressed into service on a large scale. And World War One had been a tremendous technological incentive to improve planes. And planes, you know, in that period excited young boys, you know, the dogfights and all of that kind of stuff got kids excited. And that was a big part of the reason why Charles Lindbergh, who was the following generation of aviators, and a lot of people like him, got captivated by aviation because of all the exploits they'd read about as schoolboys during World War One. And the problem was that once World War One came to an end, aviation sort of almost died. I mean, there was no real call for it. The planes weren't good enough to offer any really good passenger services, and so there just wasn't really much use for them other than a little bit of crop dusting and for carrying airmail. And even that was financially not a very attractive proposition. So you had this odd position where you had the technology was ready to do marvelous things, but the sort of infrastructure wasn't ready yet. And by 1927, that was all changing very rapidly. Suddenly it was possible for planes, because of the development of air-cooled engines, suddenly it was possible for planes potentially to fly very long distances. And that was why the summer of 1927 became this incredibly exciting race between lots and lots of competing teams, which Lindbergh was only part, to be the first across the Atlantic, not just across the Atlantic Ocean, but the first to go from New York to Paris. There was an actual award called the Ortieg Prize, which offered a lot of money for the time and a lot of prestige. And that was what was motivating people like Lindbergh to try to be the first to fly between those two cities.
You know, if I had ever known that it was part of a competition, I guess I had forgotten it, because I was a little taken aback by that. That was a very fierce competition with a lot of players. And
I was in exactly the same position as you, but I think I was even more astounded because, you know, the second person across was Clarence Chamberlain, who's from Denison, Iowa, my own home state, and I'd never heard of him. And he was, you know, he wasn't in Lindbergh's league exactly, but he was still a great hero, and he did a lot of, you know, wonderful things as an aviator, and he's just kind of vanished from the national consciousness. But, you know, we don't have so many heroes in Iowa that we can afford to kind of get some of them. And I was just completely dumbfounded that I'd never heard of him. And I went to Denison, Iowa, and I found that his hometown, and most people there have never heard of him, even in his hometown. So there were quite a lot of remarkable other aviators that summer, some of them interesting, almost all of them really very brave and daring, and most of them are almost entirely forgotten now.
And many of them died in the process, too. I mean, that was something that happened with alarming frequency.
It did indeed. Yeah. Flying across an empty ocean was really hard. I mean, it meant pushing every plane to the very limits of its capabilities. And interestingly, the reason that Lindbergh succeeded was two reasons. One was he was actually an absolutely brilliant pilot. I mean, his achievements as a solitary pilot navigator are, without compare. I mean, they were just unbelievable. But also, he was very smart to fly in a single engine plane without a co-pilot or navigator because of the weight issues. He was able to take more fuel. You know, if he'd taken another person, that would have been 150, 160 pounds of extra weight, and that would have been, they would have lost some amount of fuel, and they might not have made it across. So by flying alone, he gave himself a great physical challenge because he had to stay awake and alert and do, you know, the work of several people, navigating as well as piloting. But it also meant that he could pack on more fuel, and that's what got him to Paris pretty comfortably.
And his ability to navigate certainly is as important as his ability to fly the plane, because he landed exactly where he wanted to, and that was a lot more difficult for others who tried it.
Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, as an example, a month or so after Lindbergh's flight, another plane commanded by Commander Richard Byrd tried to duplicate his flight, but their plane had a crew of four, a pilot, co-pilot, a navigator, and a radio operator. So, I mean, a really big team. And even with all that technology in the team, they missed Ireland, their first landfall, by 250 miles. And couldn't find Paris at all. They ended up ditching in the English Channel off the coast of Normandy, which is a reflection not a reflection of their poor piloting skills, but a reflection of just how challenging it was and how brilliant Lindbergh was. Yeah.
And Chamberlain wound up in Germany.
Yes, Clarence Chamberlain and Charles A. Levine, they were quite a heroic flight. And Chamberlain was this sort of wonderfully laid-back person who was very, very easygoing about everything. I mean, he just took the view that they took off and just kept going east. They had to come to Europe eventually. And they really had no idea at all where they were going to land. And, you know, they hit Europe, of course, and then just kept going until they ran out of fuel and essentially crash-landed in a grain field in Germany. So, actually, this was just a very short time after Lindbergh's flight. They actually broke his records for distance and time in the air.
And they were well-received in Germany. One of the things that I found most interesting about your book, among many things, was the fact that almost any event drew one heck of a crowd. I mean, people were more than willing by the tens of thousands to gather, to welcome heroes or at particular events. I guess they didn't have anything else to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to make that conclusion because, I mean, people just turned out for anything. If there was anything at all going on that was mildly diverting, people turned out in the most enormous numbers. You know, I talk in one point about a famous murder case at the time, mm-hmm. known as the Sashwaite murder case, and it involved a woman and her lover who killed the woman's husband. And just when they were being transferred from a jail on Long Island to Sing Sing for eventual execution, you know, thousands of people turned up just to watch them being kind of sped out of the one prison and taken at speed to another. And people lined the route as if it was a great parade. You know, it's just extraordinary to think what people had time to do and an inclination to do.
And that was nothing compared to the turnout for Lindbergh all over the country when he made his famous tour after the flight.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I was really pleased with is that the picture researcher for my book put in, found some really good pictures of the crowds that greeted Lindbergh at various places. And if you look at those pictures, I mean, they're quite stunning. That just the mass of people, you know, most of us have never seen that many people in one place. The parade that they gave him in New York, you know, was probably about something in the region of two-thirds of all the people in the city were in Manhattan watching his parade. You know, they think it may have been up to 5 million people. That's just, you know, nothing on that scale has ever been repeated anywhere. It's just quite amazing.
One of the things you point out in your book, staying with Lindbergh for a moment, was the fact that you believe that an even greater accomplishment than his flight was gathering the money and what he needed to make that flight. And, of course, there's a very pronounced St. Louis connection to that.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, Lindbergh was a very bad bet. You know, he was a kid. He'd only been flying for about 4 years. If he had come to you and asked for money, I think, you know, you would be pretty dubious because he was just such a long shot, such a dark horse. And yet he persuaded some guys in St. Louis, which was sort of his headquarters as an airmail pilot, to fund his flight in the belief that this would, you know, by calling the plane the Spirit of St. Louis, that it would bring a lot of commercial attention to the city and it would have a big payoff in terms of prestige for the city. And he was absolutely right, because it did. And Spirit of St. Louis is a name that people all over the planet recognize.
Yeah,
at the same time, you have to think, these guys, these businessmen in St. Louis were, you know, they were investing a lot of money in an untried pilot, and the likelihood was that he would crash in the ocean and actually bring kind of ignominy on them, if not on the city of St. Louis, for sort of sending a hapless young man to his death. So it was, they were taking a big risk.
Yeah, one of the many grace notes in your book pointed out that Charles Lindbergh, who had the nickname of Slim, was 6'2" and weighed 128 pounds. No wonder he had that nickname.
he was a beanpole. But he also, you know, a huge part of the reason that he was so popular and that the world embraced him so warmly was because he did have this very, you know, he just looked like the boy next door. He was nice looking, not exactly handsome, but just a nice looking kid. You know, he just looked like a nice guy. He had a very, very modest manner. He was never boastful. He was always polite, and he was the perfect hero in every respect except one, which was that he didn't want to be a hero. I mean, he absolutely hated the spotlight and was sort of most reluctant to have the kind of attention that was thrust on him. And it was a pretty tough position for him. I mean, it would be a pretty tough position for any 25-year-old to suddenly find themselves the most famous man on Earth. But especially so for him because, here he had been completely anonymous and happily anonymous, and then suddenly everywhere he went, he's got flashbulbs going off in his face and no peace, and no escaping from the world's adulation.
Of course, that impression that this country and other parts of the world had of him changed over the years, particularly because of his association with the Nazi Party, if you will, or Adolf Hitler, or with what was going on in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, Lindbergh, you know, he's a very, very tough character. At times when I was doing the research, I felt really sorry for him, and times I felt I quite liked him, and then in the end, you know, you realize that actually, basically, he became a pretty unattractive person. So he's in extremely enigmatic character. He's he's always interesting, but not always very adorable. And what happened was that, 6 years after his flight, his baby son was kidnapped and murdered, and in a really horrible way. And Lindbergh and his poor wife had to not only go through all the bad experience, but had to do it in a very public way with lots and lots of media attention. And what happened was that to escape that, they've fled to Europe and lived first in England and then in France. And then finally they went to Germany, and Lindbergh really fell for Nazi Germany in a big way. It's unclear exactly to what extent, if any, he was anti-Semitic, but he was certainly very, very pro-German. He loved all the kind of pomp and orderliness of Germany under the Nazis. And he did turn a blind eye to a lot of ugly stuff. I mean, he was there during Kristallnacht when the Germans rioted and, beat up and humiliated a lot of Jews. And it didn't recoil from that, really. So it's hard to know exactly just how ugly he became, but he stopped being the real American hero.
Well, another American who was right in that category, as you point out in the book, is Henry Ford. And I think that he and Lindbergh, as I recall, both received some sort of an award from Adolf Hitler, the only two Americans of any note to have been given this particular award. It was a trophy of some sort, as I recall.
That's right. It was. I can't even remember what it was called, but it was like, the Iron Cross or something. It was the highest civilian award that the Nazis gave away. And as you say, Lindbergh and Ford were the only two Americans to get it. And Lindbergh, he never disowned it. He never gave it back, even during World War II. So it was not a proud moment for him or for America. And what happened with Lindbergh was that because of his pro-German views and his profound isolationist stance in the run-up to the Second World War, he stopped being a hero. And all over America, things that had been named in his honor, people renamed them. They had before people that they'd named high schools and mountains and roads and all kinds of things after him. And little by little, all those names were changed back to what they had been in the first place.
Well, another hero of the day, and you expose some warts, would, of course, be Babe Ruth, his 60 home run season. And he was a heck of a ball player, but as an individual, he could have used some improvements, I suppose.
Yeah, well, Babe Ruth was, I mean, I ended up really, really liking Babe Ruth. I think he was, he was a very appealing person. I think he was unquestionably a nice guy, well-meaning guy. And, you have to bear in mind that he had it pretty tough. I mean, he grew up in an orphanage, not because his parents were dead, but just because they didn't want him. I mean, and that's pretty serious rejection. If that had happened to me, I think I'd have grown up pretty embittered. And Babe Ruth was exactly the opposite. He was this large, good-natured, well-meaning hulk of a guy who also just happened to have the most extraordinary gift for playing baseball, and not just as a hitter. One of the things that I point out in the book is that he was so good as a pitcher in his early years that he could be in the Hall of Fame now just on his pitching record for the first few years of his career before he even started hitting home runs. So, I mean, he was extraordinary in every way, and not just, as a pitcher or hitter, but also, he had a great arm. He was a great fielder. He stole a lot of bases. He could do everything. And because he could do everything, because he was so good, he made quite a lot of money, and he didn't have any sort of discipline, and he spent it on a lot of fairly dissolute pursuits, but in a good-natured way. He wasn't ever really ugly with it. He was pretty, he did need some more discipline, but he was ultimately he was pretty good-natured about it.
Well, one thing that was clear in the book was that most people might be concerned that they wouldn't want their daughter necessarily be around Babe Ruth very long.
You wouldn't want any women you knew to be anywhere near him. And the sports writers of the day all were very complicit in covering that kind of stuff up. So Babe Ruth was able to get away with a lot that he wouldn't get away with now, because you know, sports writers, they treated him as just a big kind of good-natured guy, and they kind of indicated that he ate too much food, but never anything in the press about his drinking or his womanizing.
Well, there's so much to talk about, Bill Bryson. I have to take another break. We'll come back and continue our conversation. I'll ask our listeners to come on into it, too. If you'd like to talk to Bill Bryson, do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back with Bill Bryson in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We continue our conversation with author Bill Bryson in just a moment, but first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri Department of Corrections has announced it is returning a portion of its supply of the drug propofol to its supplier. The European company which manufactures the drug requested its return and protested its potential use in an execution here later this month. The European Union opposes the death penalty and is considering possible export limits on the common anesthetic. The Missouri Department of Corrections says its remaining supply of propofol was produced domestically. The New York-based World Monuments Fund has placed St. Louis Gateway Arch on its 2014 watch list of at-risk monuments. And the St. Louis Zoo released details about its upcoming polar bear exhibit. The $15 million polar bear point is expected to be completed in 2015. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with author Bill Bryson. He is the author of the new book, One Summer, America, 1927. Before we continue with some of the things I wanted to talk about, Bill, let's take a couple of calls from people who I think want to be talking about Charles Lindbergh. So let's do that. We'll begin with John and Godfrey. Go ahead. John, are you there? Hello, John. John is gone. We'll try Randy and Jennings. Go ahead, Randy.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, I think any conversation about Charles Lindbergh is incomplete if you don't mention the fact that he was actually the 27th person to cross the Atlantic in a nonstop airplane flight. I feel like Charles Lindbergh is one of the most overrated celebrities in history. I think when we talk about Charles Lindbergh, we're really talking about a study in celebrity itself as opposed to a figure that actually contributed anything to any field scientifically. I just wanted to throw that out there. Have a good day. I'll take my comments off the air.
Randy, thanks for the call. What do you think, Bill?
Thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I did talk about it. Charles Lindbergh was by no means the first person to fly the Atlantic. That, and I do talk about that in the book. Your caller is completely wrong in suggesting there were 27 who flew the Atlantic nonstop. That didn't happen either. The people who flew the Atlantic before him flew in seaplanes, and they had to stop in places like the Azores en route. The only people who had flown the Atlantic nonstop were Alcock and Brown, British aviators who flew from Newfoundland to Ireland in 1919. Incredibly heroic flight, but only about half the distance of the flight from New York to Paris. So Lindbergh's flight was extremely heroic, and although Lindbergh himself didn't directly contribute anything at all to the technology of flight, your caller is absolutely right about that. He did act as the most incredible spur. I mean, within the following years, $100 million of money was invested in American aviation, and within less than 10 years, we had things like the DC-3 aircraft, which was, you know, the first really successful passenger plane. And Lindbergh, not only his flight not only spurred that development, but he also made sure that the result was that all the aviation development happened in America. Boeing and Douglas exist today because of in large part because of what Lindbergh achieved in 1927.
There is one clear distortion from that era that I learned about in the book, and that is I think all of us grew up thinking that the jazz singer with Al Jolson was the first talking motion picture. But as you point out, that was far from the case.
No, there were others, and this was technology that had been you know, in preparation for some time, and there were other movies and newsreel footage and various other things that had sound and music and even voice before the jazz singer. But what the jazz singer was it was the that it was kind of the de facto first talking picture, because it was when the world discovered talking pictures and grew enchanted with talking pictures. And so it was, you know, it deserves to be regarded as a milestone event, but it does need a kind of asterisk and a footnote to explain that it wasn't literally the first talking picture.
It changed the country, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it did two things. I mean, first of all, sound pictures completely transformed, you know, popular entertainment altogether, because obviously opened up whole new dimensions of what you could present on screen and how you could convey stories and information. It made motion pictures a lot more sophisticated. But it also had the huge psychological effect of bringing American voices to the whole world. You know, silent movies, it didn't matter. Well, you know, you didn't hear anything. But with sound pictures, suddenly, what people were hearing was American voices. So even, you know, kind of Christopher Columbus and Henry VIII and people like that, who obviously didn't in reality speak with American accents, in Hollywood they were. And that had a kind of profound subliminal effect on how people perceived America in the wider world.
And it was a very, very positive impression that people had. I mean, it was really instrumental in our whole emergence as a great world power and leader.
Psychologically, yeah. America was in an interesting position in 1927 in that it was already unquestionably the richest and most dominant nation on Earth. But Americans didn't really appreciate that. Americans didn't have the confidence that you would expect would go along with that kind of dominance. And in the 1920s, we still looked to Europe for leadership in almost every field. You know, in 1927, America still hadn't won a Nobel Prize for Literature, for instance. And everybody expected that Nobel Prizes would go to Europeans, and they expected that most scientific discoveries would come from Europeans. You know, people like Einstein and Heisenberg and people like that. Those were the people who, you know, did the discovery, not Americans. So, 27 was a kind of a transition time when America suddenly really discovered itself and realized that it could lead the way in lots of different fields.
You know, a lot of actors and actresses lost their livelihood because of that, because they didn't sound very good in sound. One of them being Clara Bow, the so-called It Girl, who was a big, big star in those days. You have one little couple of sentences in there I can't resist asking you to talk about, and that is Clara Bow, was, among many things, was noted for her promiscuity. And
noted publicly for it because, again, the people who wrote about Hollywood stars were complicit in helping to keep these things submerged. But Clara Bow was definitely a firecracker, she had a number of relationships. I mean, I can't remember the exact number, but she was engaged multiple times in a period of 5 years. I mean, she was engaged. You know, a lot, and had relationships on top of that. And part of the reasons that her engagements got broken off was because her betrothed discovered that she was, you know, messing around with other people. So she was quite a handful.
Well, tell the story about the boyfriend or betrothed or whoever it was that came home and saw the bathroom door closed.
Oh yeah, he came home and discovered that there was somebody, you know, hiding, a man hiding in the bathroom, and he, you know, pounded on the door and said, "Come out of there, I'm going to knock your block off." And the door opened up, and it was a very sheepish Jack Dempsey who stepped out, who was at that time renowned as the toughest man on the planet. So I think the boyfriend probably took a couple of steps backward at that point.
Heavyweight champion of the world, and he could break a person's jaw with no problem, apparently, in the ring. Yeah, that had to be a startling moment. Let's go back to the phones, Bill Bryson. John and Godfrey has reestablished contact with us. Let's take his call. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, Don and Bill. I read a really good book recently known as Historical Fiction. It was a novel about Anne Morrow Lindbergh and her relationship with Charles, and it said that their first date, Charles took her up in a plane, and she kind of fell in love with him and flying, and she learned to fly herself, and she navigated many of his post-Paris trips. right alongside as a great wife. But the theme of the book, Bill and Don, was that Charles Lindbergh wasn't a very good husband, and that he was remote emotionally, temperamental, uncommunicative, kind of wrapped up in his thing, and didn't really treat Anne real well in the marriage. And I wondered, Bill, if you could tell me if that's true or if Charles Lindbergh was a good husband or not.
Well, it seems that he wasn't, because, I mean, they discovered after his death that he had children in Europe, that he'd had long-term and long-distance relationships with at least two German women, both of whom he had children by. So he was certainly a philanderer during marriage. But having said all that, you have to bear in mind that that's not really part of my book, except as a sort of prologue at the end, or an epilogue at the end, I mean, because my book is really about the period from May 1st, 1927 to September 30th, 1927. And at that time, in that period, he'd not even met Anne Morrow yet. He was still some months off from meeting her and starting to date her. So that's not really a central part of my book. My book is really fixed on the summer of 1927.
Although this remoteness certainly comes through in the book, even in the midst of huge crowds, he could seem remote and unmoved by all the adulation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's almost, you look at him in pictures and it looks almost as if he's got this isn't a diagnosis because I'm not qualified, but it looks almost as if he's got a touch of autism or something, that because he seems unnaturally remote. He seems at times to be, and then this was noticed by some reporters at the time, that he seemed, you know, almost unnaturally kind of immune to the attention that was going on around him, almost as if he couldn't take it in, didn't notice it, wasn't aware of it. But he, in his parades, it was often noted that he would go through his parades with a completely blank face, as if he didn't even see the people that were hysterically excited to see him.
Yeah, there's at least one picture in the book that makes it's very pronounced, that particular kind of an expression. Back to the phones, Rich in St. Charles. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Bill Bryson.
Yeah, hey, Gil, I just wanted to ask you, is there any truth to the story that during the investigation of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, it was uncovered that Charles Lindbergh actually had a participation in that because the baby was born with a less than perfect foot?
No, this is not my area of expertise at all, but I have read, a number of Lindbergh biographies, and that doesn't appear in any of them. And from what I know of Charles Lindbergh, that would be completely out of character with him. Lindbergh was a strange and aloof and distant person, but he was also, and he was sometimes misguided, but he was at root a completely decent person. And, he was always a good father to his own children. I mean, he was a little distant from them, but he was a good father and had several other children afterwards. I think there's absolutely no evidence to support that rumor.
Bill, can you connect some dots? I think we've already done this to some extent, but connect some dots between 1927 America and America today, the influence that year might have had in some areas. Have you done that in any way?
Well, I've thought about it a lot, Don, and I get asked about it a lot, and it's hard to know because, it's hard sometimes to draw a direct line, the things that happened in 1927 that they're still influencing things that are happening today. Because it's a long time ago, it's 86 years ago. But what is certainly true, and I have noticed, I did notice this again and again when I was doing the book, was that, there's nothing new under the sun. There really isn't. For instance, in the spring of 1927, just before Lindbergh's flight, there was a terrible murder of school children in Bath, Michigan, a guy who was crazy and had a grievance against the local school board in Bath. He planted a whole bunch of explosives in the basement of the school, of a consolidated school there, and detonated them when the school was full of children the next day. Luckily, a lot of the explosives didn't go off, but enough did that it killed 43 people, of whom mostly children. And that was the biggest massacre of children ever in American history. Well, obviously, you know, resonates against the killing of all those poor school children in Connecticut last year. But you can't really say there's a connection. You know, you can't say that anything happened because, you know, one influenced the other. It's just a reminder that almost everything that happens today, you know, has parallels in the past.
You live abroad, and you have for a good many years. I think many people hear a little bit of an accent because you've lived in Britain for a number of years. When you are at home, if I may put it that way, with your wife,
sure.
What do you see when you look at America today from the vantage point of being outside the country, looking in?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. At the moment, I see a nation that has the great sense to take baseball very seriously.
Hey, we've got a big game here today.
Yeah. Well, this is to me just, you know, it's the best time ever to be in America. But I do think these playoffs are shaping up to be some of the most exciting in years, just because there so many of them are close, and you know, it's hard to know who's going to win each of the divisions. So that's really exciting. But also, I mean, to answer your question slightly more seriously, I still see America as an extremely appealing society. This is the thing that's always striking to me when I come home is how friendly people are, how open they are, how welcoming people are everywhere you go. But the other thing that sort of paradoxically accompanies that, more when I read the newspapers than when I talk to people, but is how polarized it's become. The government shutdown is probably the most glaring example of that. And that's really worrying, and I know it worries a lot of people living here now, the idea that, you know, so it seems to be so hard for a lot of people to find any kind of common ground. And that, to me, that just seems very un-American. You know, it just doesn't seem right that the whole idea of America is being, you know, friendly and considerate of others, and yet the politicians seem to have lost that concept altogether.
We just have a minute left. In our stature in the world, do you see that diminished, tarnished?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, I've seen some articles saying that because of the government shutdown, that somehow is going to affect how people perceive the world, America and the wider world. I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, people still overwhelmingly look up to America. They, you know, American culture and American products and the kind of things that come out of America, you know, everything from kind of the iPad to popular television programs, people really, really admire and love those things. So I don't think that a government shutdown that doesn't actually affect people directly overseas is really going to change how people perceive the country.
Well, let me just tell our audience, if they want to reminisce, if that's even the right word, about what America was like 86 years ago, you've got to read One Summer, America 1927, by our guest, Bill Bryson. There are so many things that, Bill, you and I didn't talk about that we might have, the Sacco Vanzetti execution and jazz and the flappers and all the other things that were going on at that time, but there's an ample supply of that in the book, and I recommend it. I'm enjoying it immensely.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tom.
All righty. Bill Bryson, author of One Summer, America 1927. So appreciative that he was with us today on St. Louis on the Air. But tomorrow is another day, and tomorrow on this program we'll talk about governance and crime in the Metro East, including a conversation with St. Clair County State's Attorney Brendan Kelly and U.S. Attorney Stephen Wiginton. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.